Okay, this is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I'm here today in Worcester, Massachusetts. It's August 9th, 1993, and I'm here with Norman Simo, who came from Albania in 1938 when he was 9 years old.
That's right.
I'm very happy to be here and happy to be interviewing one more Albanian person for the collection.
It's really my pleasure, and I'm hoping that more Albanians will come forward so that we can have the artifacts and the voice recordings available to all people of the country so that they'll get an idea, you know, who's an Albanian, what is an Albanian, and is there such a country as Albania?
Well, I think that's good, and I know you've donated artifacts to the collection, and
yes.
That's what Ellis Island is all about,
representing
all the different ethnic groups.
Yeah, that was our pleasure. My wife and I wanted to do this so that we could preserve something for the future of those that are researching Albania, and when they visit Ellis Island, they want to see the artifacts and maybe understand what all America is about. That it's like a more or less a ceramic where you see different nations, different countries making a contribution that makes up the total of America.
Well, I'm really happy, and I look forward to hearing your particular story. Why don't we start at the beginning, if you would tell me your birth date.
I was born January 28th, 1929, and I was born in Permet, P-E-R-M-E-T, Albania. And it was a home delivery. I mean, you know, they had no hospitals there or anything, so I was delivered at home. As a matter of fact, they said that I was like a large baby, 10 pounds, 6 ounces. So everybody was, wow. They were kind of like astonished.
Were you the first child?
No, I was the second child. I have an older brother who unfortunately passed away. But I'm the second. And then we had a young sister who unfortunately passed away also. And I have a younger brother that was born here. And
what was your sister and brother who were born in Albania? What were their names?
My sister was born here. My brother was born in Albania, and I was born in Albania. My brother was 2.5 to 3 years older than myself.
And what was his name?
Charles.
Charles. Yeah. Okay. And your sister and brother who were born here?
Yes. Janet and Steve.
Okay. And your mother's name?
Hariklia. Yes. H-A-R-I-K-L-I-A. Hariklia. Isn't that something? Now, when we first came here, it wasn't Simo, it was Simolari. S-I-M-O-L-L-A-R-I. And when my father came, I guess he came in 1920s. 21 or something like that. And He originally lived in Philadelphia, and his uncle, which was my grandfather's brother, had cut the name to Simo. So my father did the same thing. He cut the name down to Simo. So when we arrived here, they changed our names to Simo.
I see. So when you got on the boat, was it Simo?
It was Simolari.
Simolari.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, and I donated the card to Ellis Island, stating, you know, and with my picture, my arrival card from Albania, and Simolari is on there.
So when you were in Albania up until the age of 9,
yes.
You were Simolari.
Yes, uh-huh. Yes, that's right.
Okay, well, the town where you were born.
Yes.
Do you remember it?
Very well.
Describe it?
Oh, very well. It was, when you're 9 years old, you think it's a large town. Since I've been there, I found out it's really a small, very small town. It's in southern Albania. And the climate is similar to California. They have orange trees, pomegranates, fig trees, just to give you an idea of the climate and what it contains. It it's probably population of maybe 12 or 13,000. You know, in those days, we thought that was a large town, a large city. It was a popular trading center, believe it or not. And a lot of goods used to flow through. They had open markets. I remember them very well. As a matter of fact, when we were kids, we used to go down and get a few oranges on the side, naturally, as a kid. And it had two churches. It had one synagogue. It had a temple, the mosque. It had no hotels, but a lot of individual houses. And the industry, of course, was farming. You know? And it had a large river. I remember the river, my God, during the spring, when you had the melts, there used to be the overflow. I mean, speak about floods and currents fast flowing. I remember one time my cousin's house, who lived close to the river, it not only got flooded out, but they stones came rolling down. So this one time, it was probably in 1935 or something, 34 or 35, we visited. We heard about the bad flood when the river had swelled. And they said, well, there's a big stone that landed in their yard. My God, we thought it was a rock. This thing was like the size of the house. So you could imagine the force of that river and how devastating it was.
Do you remember the name of it, the river?
I think it was the Volga.
Volga.
Yeah.
Well, now, you say it was a trading town.
Yes.
Trade was going from other countries?
There was a trading within the country itself, where they bought goods and so forth. And people came from all over. It had a reputation for all kinds of goods. So they must have been bringing goods in from other countries as well and trading there, because it's near the border of Greece. And the farming goods were available readily. And, you know, there was no storage area. So they had to make sure that they sold them the goods rather quickly.
You remember market days?
Yes, there were market days, particularly on the weekends. The market days on the weekends were abundant, and it was like an open market. I remember when I first came to the United States in Worcester, they had an open market right by the bus station, you know, the old bus near the Worcester Common, and it was similar to that. All the farmers would bring their goods in. And they would just open blankets up, they set their goods out, and people would come in and buy and purchase from all over.
So that was, what do you remember about the market in Albania? Was it all produce, or was it other things too?
It was produce, and they had farm, like animals and of that nature. And they had goods like blankets and what have you. I remember all that. Yeah. Yeah, so it was really quite interesting. You know, there were stores, too, around. So, in other words, it was like an open, large plaza where they used to stretch out their goods. But then surrounding the plaza were all these little shops that sold individual items. They specialized in one area. Someone would specialize in blankets, someone a tailor. You know, it's a butcher or a baker. It was one of those things. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you have fond memories of
childhood there. It was pleasant. It really was.
What was the countryside like?
The countryside was more or less like farmland and groves. Mm-hmm. And, like corn and wheat. They had olive groves. Olives grew readily. And pomegranates and figs. And grapefruits. Quince. But large size quince. I haven't seen anything comparable here, to be honest with you. The oranges were quite large, and they were thick skinned, but they were also juicy. I've seen the Jewish people that have brought in from Israel thick skinned oranges, or from California, the sun kissed, not the Florida type. The Florida type is a thin skin type. But that's the kind of they were growing.
Do you remember the house you lived in there?
Yes, very well. Yeah, it was a two-story. I remember the cellar very well. It was dark, and we were kind of like afraid to go in the cellar.
What did you have in the cellar?
There wasn't that much in the cellar, but I mean, you know, it kind of like was so dark there was no electricity, you know. So you more or less went with a candle or a lantern, and it said, "Stay away from the cellar." So who knows what they had down the cellar? We really never went into the cellar. It was kind of like a scary thing, you know. And then there was upstairs. Upstairs there were five or six rooms. It was quite large. One of the rooms, we call it the parlor, more or less. It was a combination living room and a bedroom, and we used to sleep there on the floor, naturally on mattresses. And we had the fireplace there, and all your more or less expensive furniture was in that one particular room. And there were separate bedrooms. But we never used the separate bedrooms. We more or less all stayed in that one room. So
it was warmer, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. It was warmer, and it kind of like gave you a feeling of security, too, that you didn't have to worry about or be afraid of anything.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Then there was some attic rooms upstairs. I used to visit those every once in a while, just out of curiosity.
And what was up there?
That was like more or less a storage area. They used to store things up there.
Yeah.
Food, like in sausages. You know, they would hang the sausages from the ceiling and dry them out. And then when they were cured, then they would eat and use that, more or less. Yeah, it was very interesting. You know, it's amazing how they did things in those days. Yeah.
Do you remember your mother preparing the sausages? Is she the one?
Yes, she had a hand machine. And they used to use the guts from sheep. They loved the lamb, you know. They used to go down to the market and would buy them, and they would grind it up and they would stuff it by hand, grind it up in this little hand machine, and they would mix it all up, and then they would stuff it in here, and the skin, you know, and they would slowly just keep filling it up and filling it up until it was complete, and then they would tie it up with this string.
And then hang it in the attic?
And then they would hang it up in the attic and let it just drip and dry up and use it for the winter. Or they would use it immediately. The company came, but they would cook it differently. And, you know, once it dried up, they could fry it. But if it was fresh, they would bake it. Amazing. Yeah, or they would make, you know how they make the shish kebab? Well, they call this kolofatze. You know, this
how do you spell that?
Kolofatze, K-O-L-O-F-A, fatze, T-A. It's close,
mm-hmm.
Kolofatze. It was a delicacy, really.
And then how would they serve it?
They would serve it with rice pilaf, and they would serve it with peppers. You know, they would kind of like fry the peppers in olive oil, pure olive oil, and they would chill the peppers. They wouldn't serve it hot. The rice was hot, but the peppers were chilled, and they would pour a little vinegar and oil after. And you would eat it that way. Oh, it was delicious.
Now, that's if it was fresh.
It was fresh,
now,
right.
If it was dry?
If it was dry, they had more like sausages. Then they could add potatoes, or they could add eggplant or peppers, yeah, or tomatoes. It was,
Do you remember any other dishes that were really Albanian?
Oh, yeah. Well, the lamb, you know, we're lamb lovers. We love to eat lamb. You know, also like stuffed peppers and stuffed tomatoes. That was one of our delicacies. Our stews with lamb. Again, our lamb, the stews we cooked with lamb, and you would use like string beans. You would use okra. Okra is another thing that grows very well in Albania, so that was part of it. There was also stuffed zucchini. And there was stuffed eggplant. Now, this isn't the round eggplant. This was the long, thin eggplant. They would stuff those. And, you know, it's really amazing what they would do. I remember also where we had, she would make, my mother would make, it was not spaghetti, but like rigatoni. And she would cook that. And she would use cream cheese. And another kind of like cottage cheese. And she would mix that up. She would cook them and mix that up. And it was like unbelievable, unbelievable taste.
Was your mother a particularly good cook?
Oh, yeah. She was a great cook.
Well, tell me more about your mother. What kind of a person was she?
Oh, she was unbelievably, what a brave friend. Let me tell you an incident that happened in Albania. We were up in the attic, my brother and I and a friend. And when we were up there, all of a sudden, a snake was in the attic. All of a sudden, she saw the snake without thinking. There was a can there, a can. She went, grabbed the can, and the bottom had an edge, a thin edge, around the bottom of the can, and she went and pounced on that snake, and she killed it right then and there. Now, without even thinking, I mean, Mike, just think about it, right? And that's the kind of a person, but she was sweet and warm and lovable and an angel. I mean, everybody will tell you she was an angel. Yeah, I was blessed. I really was blessed with a sweet, wonderful mother. She cared for us, she took care of us, and really loving. Yeah.
What was her maiden name?
Adams. Yeah.
That doesn't sound Albanian.
We anglicized it when we came here. It was really over there. It was like Thomas, you know. Thoma, Thoma. So, you know, but they said here it comes out to Adam. Yeah. who knows, right? They changed a lot of names when they came here to Ellis Island.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now, your father, what was his name?
Kotsi. K-O-C. It's like a ch-I. Kotsi. Gus, he would call himself Gus.
Now, he came over here before?
Oh, yeah. He came here in very early 1920s with my grandfather and my uncle, my father's brother, younger brother. And they resided originally in Philadelphia. And they used to use a push cart. That's how they made their living, a push cart, selling ice cream or, Italian ice or something like that, which was ice, they told me, crushed ice, with, syrup on it. Yeah, and that was a popular number. But that was so backbreaking because the roads, there were dirt roads. And pushing that, if it got wet or something, if it rained, it was really a horror story.
So how long did they stay here then?
They stayed in Philadelphia. Well, my father stayed here, and he just went for a visit. In other words, he went for a visit. That's how I became known. Now, I never knew my father. I didn't meet my father until I came to the United States. My grandfather had made some visits. He had made a couple of visits, several visits. So I knew him. But I never knew my father until we arrived in the United States 9 years later.
Well, then he must have visited before your brother was born, too.
He got married. You know, he visited, then he got married. He came to Albania, he got married, you know, and then he came back to the United States. Now, he never took, I don't know why he didn't take my mother. Well, I guess because his mother and sister were there. I guess, you know, that we were established with the home. We had our own home. And I guess because of that, they probably figured they were just going to come here, make their fortune, then return. I'm sure a lot of them had the same thought that they were going to make their fortune and return back to the homeland, and it just didn't work out that way.
Do you remember any stories about your mother and father? I mean, how they happened to marry each other?
You know what? That was an arranged kind of a marriage. My mother came from Buali.
Spell it.
Buali, it's a capital B-U-A-L-I-A, Buali. And my father lived in Premet. Now, my mother was the youngest of 14 children. And she was the last daughter, you know? So, I mean, you know, and she came from like a very wealthy family. They had two homes. The smallest home was something like 22 rooms. So the larger home, which is now a museum, by the way, in Albania, they made it a museum. And the larger home had about 40 some odd rooms, and it was like a big farm, big ranch, and it was like an estate, more or less. You know, so then they heard about my father. So then we had relatives that were living in Albania. My mother had some sisters and brothers that lived in Permit. So then they found out that this young man from America wanted to get married, and they fixed him up. And that's how they met. They met at church, and they got married, and that was it.
Well, now, was it considered, I guess it was considered a good thing for a young woman to marry a man who had gone to America?
Yes. And, well, they thought that it was going to be, you know, they knew the families. They always knew the background of each family. So, I mean, if they fixed someone up, it wasn't to a complete stranger. You know, we might think, oh, my God, you mean they didn't meet before this? But they knew the families. They knew who the young couples were. And they knew that they were compatible.
Yeah. Did your father come from also a well-established family?
Oh, yes. Yes, a well-established family. As a matter of fact, one of my uncles used to hang out with he was like the Shah of Turkey. You know, he became like the king, you know, the Shah of Turkey. And he came from a well-established family, and they had doctors and lawyers in the family and professional people. So, you know, my background is more or less solid. Mm-hmm. You know?
I'm just going to turn this off for a minute.
Go ahead.
Because there's someone making noise here in the back. Okay, we're resuming now, having closed the door.
Okay.
Is there a name of the museum that was in your mother's family that is in Albania now?
It would be the Thomas Estate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they've just made this more or less like a museum. And They have tourists going there and everything else.
Yeah. So for your father, what had he done in Albania before he went to the United States? Do you know?
Well, he was very young when he came over here. He was only like 16 or 17 himself. Oh, so he really hadn't done anything. And when he found out that there was a lot of hard work in pushing those wagons and selling ice cream on the streets, then he decided to go into the food business. So he became more or less like a busboy in a restaurant. And his interest was to learn about food all that he could. And he became, believe it or not, he became a top chef. So well-known a chef that he could write his own ticket in the Worcester and Boston area. He became very well-known. You know, it's unfortunate. I wish he had written a book or something with all the knowledge, and you know, because he had so many good recipes. You know?
Well, do you remember, like, when you and your mother and your brother?
Yes.
Is that who you traveled with when you came?
Okay, when we came, it was my grandmother, Varvara. It was my aunt, Persephone. Unfortunately, who just passed away. She would have been an ideal candidate as well. It was my brother, my mother, and myself that came over.
Well, at what stage in your father's career was he when you and your family came here?
Okay.
What was he doing?
He just established himself as a chef in a restaurant, a cook and a chef. And he was doing very well. You know, as a chef who's a master. As a matter of fact, he serviced many of the restaurants in the Worcester area. He was very well known, and they always asked for him. Come on, work here. Come on, and work here. You know?
So, and is that the reason that you and your family came at that point? Because your father had finally sort of made it as a chef in demand?
I don't think so. I think what had happened, the winds of war, this was in 1938, the winds of war were really blowing, and they were afraid that if they didn't bring us over when they did, that God knows the whole family could have been wiped out in Albania. So it was by the grace of God that we arrived here. Actually, when we arrived here, it was on Armistice Day, November 11th. It was like a blessing. Can you imagine arriving here on November 11th and on April 1st, the following year, 1939, April 1st, which is a matter of, 4 or 5 or 6 months, Albania was attacked. And if we didn't get out when we did, we would have been stuck. And God knows what would have happened. Yeah, mm-hmm. I remember when I went back for a visit in 1984, a couple of my friends that I used to hang around with were killed in the war. Yeah? They were killed by the Nazis. Yeah, one of them was taken, and he was captured. He was shot. Yeah? It was very, oh, God. Yeah. When you think of it, it was really devastating what the Nazis had done.
So you were more or less in a fatherless family for your first 9 years.
Yeah.
And did your mother work? Or?
No, my mother didn't work. As a matter of fact, when you think of it, they're all only women, with the exception of my brother and I, and we were very young. So they didn't work. We used to get money from over here, from America, from my father. He would send the money over. Yeah.
Do you remember any experiences as a young boy with your grandmother in Albania?
Oh yeah. I remember some of the customs that we used to have. During the New Year, in order to celebrate the New Year, they would go out and get some pine. So there was a special pine tree out in the woods. We'd have to get some of the pines, and we'd get some of the old wood, and they would burn this to kind of like burning in the old and bringing in the new. That was very interesting. And then we would set a table laden with food and all kinds of goodies, And then we would shake the table, pick it up and shake it 3 times.
Tablecloth?
The whole table.
Oh, the table.
You would pick up, everybody would just gather around the table and they would sing Oleg Bulek, and kind of like bringing in the new year and bringing in hopefully a better year. That was one of the incidences. And I remember she used to take me to church all the time.
What church?
Every Sunday, the Albanian Orthodox Church was just up the street from us. It was, when you're small, It's like 500 feet is a long ways off, but it really wasn't that far. We used to go not only on Sundays, but every like major holidays, and we'd be doing something, and she'd say, "Oh no, don't do that now. It's a holy day. You can't do that." So they had all these holy day customs. I think they set that up themselves, so they wouldn't have to do any work.
So there were a lot of holy days.
There were a lot of holy days, saint days and everything else. Amazing.
Well, how about school? Do you remember school?
Yes, I remember school. The school was 2 houses up from us where we lived. And the church was right next door to the school. So you can imagine how close
we were.
It was a public school. And it only went up to the 6th grade. Then after you finished that school, then you went on to a higher school. Now, if you went to the higher school, you had to make sure that you passed certain exams and were qualified and knew that material or could do the higher schools. But I remember doing the multiplication table and the words and the spellings and everything else like that. And gymnastics was also a very, every part of it. I guess they believed in a healthy mind and a healthy body. It's the old Plato philosophy.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You went then to school here after you
Yes,
here?
Yes.
How did the school in Albania compare to the school when you got here?
I have an interesting experience that happened. When I came here, I mean, all I could speak was Albanian. So when I came here, I had some friends that I met. They lived in the same house. We lived in the three-decker. They lived in the same house. They lived in the first floor. Bobby and Paul. I don't remember their last name, but I remember their first names. And the school was Winslow Street, which was just down the road. It's not there anymore. It's gone now. They took us to that school. All I could do was more or less like sign language. If I was hungry, you know, I would make a sign that I'm hungry, then, you know, for my stomach, or thirsty, I wanted to drink, I would make a through sign language. When I first started school, they started me in the first grade because I didn't know the language. And when I went there, now in those days, the teacher would read from the Bible and the kids would say the prayer. So I said to myself, oh my God, the teacher is reading and they're remembering what the teacher is reading and they're reciting it back. So I'm saying, boy, I better learn the language quickly or I'm going to find myself at the bottom of the ladder. So I made a point to make sure I learned the language as quickly as I could.
Did you remember when you were learning it, any kind of breakthroughs that you experienced in learning the language?
There was a fellow by the name of Johnny Jones that was Albanian. He knew some Albanian that was at the school. So I couldn't speak any English. They brought him over, and they said, well, he can speak some Albanian. When I saw him and he started speaking Albanian, I gave him a big hug. It was like, oh, thank God there's someone here I can communicate with and tell him how I feel and what I'm thinking and, you know, what I want to do and what I want to know. So that's how he became more or less my tutor at the very beginning, at the early stages, until I picked up the words. And believe it or not, within 6 months, I was speaking the language. It's amazing. It's just, I guess Albanian is the language. Albanian is very close to a lot of languages, including French and Latin and English. So it kind of like came relatively easy.
Yeah. So do you remember excuse me, talking about the school in Albania?
Yes.
Was there anything different about that?
Yeah, it was more strict and structured. It was more mechanical, whereas here you had the independence to think and kind of like bring up different thoughts. Over there you were structured, you do this and you do that and you do this. Then everybody in the whole room recites this and, you know, you do this and report. You made sure you listened to the other person. No one got out of the line. I mean, the teacher was the teacher, period. And that was it. And when you learned, it was so structured that everybody was like, I mean, yeah, you were like, okay, this is it. You have to do this. And you do it this way. There's no other way. This is the way we all do this. And you would do it.
Yeah. Are there any other ways or customs that you remember from Albania that are particular to that place that either your mother carried over or dropped, but things in Albania that were particular?
Oh, yeah, like the weddings. Oh, the weddings were unbelievable. They would last a whole week. And when they sent out invitations, it was Nisim Barim. That was beginning to the end. The beginning started 1 week before. And the end was like one day after the wedding was over. So you needed like to more or less to recuperate. And they had a night where they would visit the bride. The groom's family would visit the bride. And they would go in there, you know, unannounced, and kind of like ransack the house, not you know, ransack to get some artifacts of the girl, of the bride to be, and then bring him to the house of the groom, you know, the future groom, and then they in turn, the following day would do the same, or the following evening would do the same thing.
You mean, yeah, the parents of the bride?
The whole family. In other words, uncles and cousins that would visit the groom's house and then try and get some artifacts. And then when the wedding came, at the wedding, they would bring all these gifts out and present them to the couple. It was amazing, yeah?
Well, what What would they choose? Like, what kinds of
They would choose, like, pillows and pillowcases and doilies and pictures and, you know, things of that nature. Yeah.
And then these artifacts would be for the bride and groom to
to start their own house with, you know? Or if they didn't want to, they would return them back to their original families. But it was so interesting that they would do something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And then they always went and picked up the bride. They wanted to make sure that the bride didn't jilt them. So they would make sure that they went there and picked up the bride. Then they had a Vlam. Vlam would be like a brother, you know? And he would make sure that the bride came with us. The groom wouldn't see the bride.
This is the day of the wedding.
Yeah, the day of the wedding. And they would take the bride and into a, well, they didn't have automobiles there, into a horse or a mule or a donkey, or whatever means of transportation. On a rare occasion, maybe someone would bring in a car, but I mean, or, you know, a horse-drawn wagon or something like that. But they would make sure that they picked up the bride so that the bride would be at the church.
Was jilting a common thing?
No, it was not. But I mean, you know, this is one way of saying, hey, don't worry, the wedding is going to go on. So, you know.
And what would the bride be wearing?
The bride would be wearing a veil and a gown, a beautiful gown. And the face was not seen. You didn't see the face. Yeah. One of the things that they were afraid of, that's why they would make sure that they would check out, they would pick up the bride, that they didn't switch
brides.
They didn't switch brides.
Did that happen sometimes?
On occasion it happened. They would switch brides. That certain sister that couldn't get married, they would switch them to one that was, you know, pleasant. they wanted to make sure that all the girls get married. Yeah.
Was the bride wearing white as they do here?
Yes, the bride would wear white. And they also had some, like, color. Not just white. They had white underneath, but then they had, like, a color vest. Beautiful, you know. Decorated in jewelry. Yeah. And then they had, the church had crowns, so that when they got married, they were crowned in church, and those crowns stayed with the church as a permanent kind of, they would use them for different weddings, different brides and grooms.
And were flowers involved?
Yes. Yeah, they always had some flowers, and then they had a banquet, a big banquet afterwards. I mean, and sometimes the banquet, the bride and groom would leave, the banquet would continue for 24 hours or more. So they really enjoyed the weddings.
Would the bride and groom go on a honeymoon?
No, they were more or less give them a home somewhere. They would stay independently in someone's house. They would leave and they would stay there. That would be their honeymoon cottage. I mean, at least they gave them a chance to be alone, right, and get to know each other.
Well, everybody else was at the banquet.
Right, that's right. They're all at the banquet enjoying themselves.
Well, how about funerals? Do you remember any?
Yeah, the funerals were, yes. You know, surprisingly, you brought those up. Everybody had one grave lot. They had one grave lot. It was a family lot. And they would bury everybody in this one grave. And then after a year, they would go and dig up the bones, and they would clean them, wash them, oil them, and then gather them together and put them in the corner of the lot. And they would just store them. It's amazing how I remember these things. You know, so
when they put them in the corner of the lot, they were above the ground?
No, they were in the ground, but they were in the ground. But they were like all that one person, this is all his bones. And this other one person, all his bones were all gathered so that they didn't distribute all the bones separately. They would keep them intact. This person's head and, the skull and all the bones were together. And this is one person, here's another person. And
then they'd bury them?
They would bury them up in the top, at the head of the casket, more or less. Yeah, so that they could have maybe 10, 15, 20 skulls there with the bones. Yeah. So all family members were buried in that one plot. Yeah.
So in other words, when they buried them first,
yeah,
and they stayed buried for a year, the body would all decompose.
Yes,
by the time
yes.
they dug it
by the
back
time,
up.
Right. By the time they dug it back up, all it was bones, and they would clean the bones, and you know, they would bring them to church, yeah, and pray for them, and they would clean them and wash them, and would bring them back into the grave. Yeah, it's amazing.
Now,
yeah.
Who would clean the bones? And
the family members. It would be a wife or a mother.
And do you remember what they cleaned them with?
Yeah, they cleaned them with first they would rinse them with water and soap, and then they would bathe them with olive oil. Yeah, with olive oil and some like incense and myrrh. You know what I mean? Yeah, they had some portions, sweet smelling portions. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. So were there any ceremonies surrounding?
Oh, yeah, there was, I was going to say funeral. You had the funeral services. You know, they would take them to church and so forth. And then they would march with the cross. They would lead the procession with a cross and the priest behind, and they would carry the caskets, and then the people behind the casket, they would all march to the cemetery. Now, the cemetery was a distance away.
From the church.
From the church, right. And so everybody would just go to the cemetery. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah.
Did they have the casket before the church service? Would it be on display?
Yes, it would be. They would always display them at home. And you know that big room I was telling you about, the parlor? Yeah, they would display them in the home, in parlor. And they had the mourners. There would be these women that would just stay up all night with the body, and they would mourn, and some of those songs, you know, they would just to make sure everybody cried. I guess they knew that people got depressed, and the loss, to get over the loss, they would cry, and they would kind of like chant and sing these songs about the person, you know. Oh, he was such a good man, and he did this, and he did that, and he was married, and he had two kids, and the kid's name was such and such, you know, and he loved them, and he'd do this, and he would play with them, so that they would bring out all this kind of thing. And then each individual that would hear it, you know, would think of that individual person, and then think of all the good things that they had done, and cry over it, and kind of like try and get over the emotional factors of it. So it's interesting when you think about it.
Therapeutic idea. Well, now these women were professional mourners?
No, they were more or less the family members. They would gather and do this, and the women always, the minute the head of the family died, they would wear black. The women automatically wear black. I mean, they could be 25 years old and they would wear black.
How long would they wear? Yeah,
they'd wear them forever. Amazing. Bravo. And then for like 60 days, they would wear a black armband. You know, the men would wear a black armband, indicating that there was a death in the family. Yeah. It's amazing, amazing. Even today, when I went over there, they still do that. I can't believe it.
Is there any particular religious idea about death that is unique to the Albanian Orthodox Church?
No. Death, as a matter of fact, you're supposed to be ready for, you know, death is just a passing from one phase to another. It's just a passing stage. But I guess it's the loss within the family, when you think about the loss within the family, that kind of like, this person is gone, he's no longer in our eyes, in our sight, he's only in our memory, and we miss him, and that's the kind of depression, you know. They were depressed about that. That they're not. That person is no longer going to be with them.
But yeah. the idea of such a complete mourning is really.
When you think of
wonderful.
It is. When you think of it.
So we've talked about weddings and deaths and ceremonies. Was there any ceremony surrounding birth?
Yes, there was. Funny you brought that out. When someone was born in a family, they would make what they call petula.
Spell it.
P-E-T-U-L-A, petula. And petula would be like beignets in French, beignet, the fried dough. And they would then go out, you know, the children would go out and announce to everybody and give them a pantalon and announce the birth of that child. So everybody knew now that there was a child born in that family. And at baptism, when they had the baptism, normally the cumbare, that would be the person that's standing in for the youngster, would give the name to the youngster, the cumbare, the person that's sponsoring the child, would give the name to that youngster. The parents did not know what name they were going to pick. So now what happens? Then they would announce in church at the baptism, what will you name this child? And I named this child so-and-so. Now, the minute that name gave out, someone would run to the house and let the family know what the name of the child was. And the first one that arrived at the house would receive a coin or two as a reward for giving them the name of the youngster. Unbelievable. Isn't that something, huh?
Now, the sponsor, who would that sponsor be?
It would be someone within the family, you know.
Would it be like a godfather?
Yeah, it would be the godfather. Yeah, it would be the godfather. Yeah, the godfather would name the youngster. Unbelievable, huh?
And how do you spell that word?
Cumbare. 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 K-U-M-B-R-A. Cumbare. Yeah.
So the baptism was when the name was given, and then what other ceremonies did an Albanian child go through? Birth, baptism.
Well, those were the majors. Then the weddings.
The weddings.
Yeah, those were the major ones. Yeah. And sometimes they didn't even name the. You know, they didn't have the baptism for a year or two. Yeah. So they would say baby so and so. Unbelievable, yeah. But I'm sure that the mothers get together with the cumbare, you know, and exchange some kind of feelings as to what the name should be.
Well, what would be the basis for naming?
Well, generally, the basis would be if they were born on a particular day, they would find out the saint of that day, and they would more or less take the saint's name of that day. So that would be more or less the basis of it.
And then were there name days?
Yes. Oh, people celebrated their name days. They would visit the name days. It would be a big thing. They'd have the dinner and they'd have all kinds of refreshments and entertainment. It was like open house. Name days was open house for everybody. Friend and foe alike.
Foes would come.
The doors were wide open. That was one way of breaking the ice of someone that was angry at a family member. So they would come for the name day. And, you know, it's really great when you think about it. And then they would break the ice and kind of like more or less say, hey, look, what are we angry about? Let's forget those things and let's get it resolved and come to an understanding.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Now, would a saint have more than one date?
No, because the saint, they would take the saint when the saint died. They wouldn't take when
the saint died.
Yeah, they would. Yeah, that would be the saint. So it was, they usually named the saints when they died, not when they were born. I don't know why, you know. But that's when they. So when a person was born, a saint had died on that day. That saint would be probably renewed within that one person, or maybe the guardian of that person in. Throughout their living life. Huh? Isn't that something? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think there was a saint who died on every day of the year?
I'm sure there was. I'm sure that they have saints that died on every year. Yeah.
Wow. Well, is there anything else? My goodness.
We're running out of time?
This is fascinating. No, we'll keep going.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you can think of about Albania and the customs and the ways of your family in particular or the people in general before we...
Yeah, everybody knew each other. I mean, literally, everybody knew each other. And whether you were Muslim or Jewish or Orthodox or Catholic or what have you, it didn't make any difference. You know, you were an Albanian and you were part of everybody and everybody's life. It was like a universally accepted individual. If you were Albanian, hey, my house is open, my door is open to you. So that was always, as far as I can remember, the house was always open. Everybody was welcome.
Do you have any interpretation of why the Albanians were so close-knit as a group?
Yes. You have to remember that the Albanians were in captivity for over 500 years. Over 500 years. And they only had each other. So that when the Ottoman Empire, you know, the Albanians, through Skënderbeu, they called George Kastrioti, Skënderbeu, he kind of like held the Ottoman Empire back. Albania was the front that held the Ottoman Empire back for over 25 years. And then Europe recovered, and they stopped him after that. As a matter of fact, there's a large statue, and he was honored by the Pope of the time, and there's a statue in the papacy about this individual who stopped the Ottoman Empire and stopped the, you know, from the conquest of the Ottoman Empire.
What you know? Was the title that was given to this Albanian who stopped the...
Well, he became like the king, you know? Skënderbeu. He was from Brit.
How do you spell Skënderbeu?
Skënderbeu. Skënder. S-K-E-N. Skënder. D-E-R. B-E-A-U. Beu. You know? Skënderbeu, that means he was like the king of Albania. He was captured by the Turks when he was 9 years old and taken in captivity to the palace of the Sultan, and he was raised there, and he was forced to join the army. He was an intelligent individual. He was a good soldier, a well-trained soldier, and he had a quick mind. He had a good military mind. So they kind of like made him an officer and increased him in rank. Then when he became older, then they attacked, the Ottomans attacked Albania. Then he found out that he was Albanian. So he defected and went to Albania and became a general in the army of Albania. And he knew all their tactics. And the majority of, they called them the generali. The generali were like their crack troops, the Turkish crack troops. Most of them were captured Albanians that they had trained and become soldiers. And they were the vicious generali. They were the most vicious soldiers and the most destructive. Well, he knew a lot of them. You know?
And he, what years are you talking about?
You're talking about in the 1400s, 1425, 1440s, in that era. So he really, you know, he held back the Ottoman Empire. Then they fell. They became part of the Ottoman Empire. Unfortunately, Europe didn't come to their rescue, and they were in captivity until 1912. They became their slaves. Yeah. Sad. It's really sad.
So that's why...
So what happened was, then, right, exactly, they were so, slaves and brutalized and, some of the horror stories, it's unbelievable, that they became... The more in captivity they became, the closer knit family they all became.
So you must have known, or people in your own family, who remember the captivity.
Oh, yes. The atrocities and captivity and what have you. They used to tell me there were, at one time, there was a pregnant woman, and these two soldiers, I guess they must have been drunk. They came up, they made a bet. I'll bet you she has a boy. No, she has a girl. No, she has a boy. And they cut her open, took the baby out to determine whether it was a boy or a girl. Yeah.
So you, did people discuss those things when you were a little boy?
They try to hide them from us, you know, more or less.
But how did you know about them?
Then when we came over here, then they started telling us those stories. Yeah. Then they kind of like talk, and we would listen. You know, talk to, amongst themselves. We would listen. We'd pick up all these different stories, atrocities, and you know, it's man's inhumanity to man, and it still goes on.
Right now in Albania.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank God now they have their democracy. They're living in democracy now, and they're trying to change things and become a democratic country.
Yeah. Okay, so when your father, I guess it was because the war was brewing.
Yes.
The Second World War.
Yeah, Second World War was brewing.
Is when your father sent you tickets? Is that what
yep,
he did?
They decided that it's time that we came over. So they made all kinds of arrangements. Now, in those days, you had to have, you know, you had to have security and you have to have a home. So they had a house. You know, they didn't have, I mean, they were renting a house. Then they had good jobs, good paying jobs, and they could well afford to bring us over without any difficulty, that we would not be a burden to the country. So they had to get visas and permission from the government of the United States to bring us over here. And it wasn't easy because, like I said, again, you know, the King Zog of Albania was thinking of his own neck and trying to flee the country at the same time that Europe is brewing and Italy is ready to conquer and come over and try and conquer Albania. So it was really difficult times. You know, it wasn't much after that when Hitler invaded Poland. So, you know, it was just the war was brewing, and Chamberlain was trying to make the peace with Hitler and trying to establish. So these things were all in works, and the armies were building, and the Nazis were growing more powerful, and the Italians were growing in strength and building up their army. So it was a very, very touchy time of the year.
So, in other words, it took quite a while, and you were, like, waiting to receive your visa?
Yeah, there was a bus just, yeah, as a matter of fact, it was tricky getting out of Albania. We went from Permet we traveled by bus to the capital, which is Tirana, T-I-R-A-N-A, Tirana, and that's another story. That bus trip is another story because it's all mountainous country, and it was like during the time of the rains and so forth. You know, the rainy season, and I remember the rivers. My God, at one point, the bus stopped, and the mountain was so steep, and the road was so curvy that the bus driver says, well, if you want to walk, in case the bus went over the cliff, walk and I'll meet you down at the bottom. So we got off the bus and we walked the mountain down to the bottom. And then we got back on the bus and we went. Then we came to this river. We came to this river near Tirana. And the thing, wouldn't you believe it? It was like overflowing. And the bridge was threatened. And so they had a pulley, a seat pulley. Now, either you took a chance with the bus and crossed the bridge, or you could get off and go over, get on this pulley, a seat pulley, and then pull you over the river on ropes. I remember that vividly.
Did you go on the bus?
We went on the bus. We took a chance. What happened is after a couple of mountains, we trusted the bus. So we knew. That's funny, isn't it? We knew that the bus was safe enough. If he's taking a chance, then we're going to take a chance with him. So we stayed on the bus. And there was peddlers all along the way, you know. They knew that these buses were coming and people were hungry. And they would sell food. They would sell chicken legs and they would sell fruit and all kinds of meat and so forth, or tea and coffee and what have you. And you could buy food along the way.
Well, what did you bring with you and your family? What kind of luggage?
Okay, we brought, one of the things that we brought, and I don't know why, were these silk cocoons. I remember them vividly. We brought up the silk cocoons you know how they make silk? Yeah, there's a worm, you know? And there's a certain tree, that the mulberry tree, that has this worm. And then the caterpillar would make a home. And this was the silk. This is how silk is made.
Out of the mulberry leaves?
No, out of the cocoon that the caterpillar made. And that was the silk, and it would excuse me. Then they would make this home, and there would become butterflies after that, and they would leave their cocoon. They would gather those, and that was the silk that they would spin and make silk out of that. It's amazing, you know?
So yeah. your mother and grandmother brought some of those cocoons,
and they brought some pictures, and they brought some, they didn't bring any furniture. They brought, like, tableware and some dishes.
Did they bring pictures of people?
Yeah, pictures of people, yeah.
Well, did your mother... Wait, we're going to pause now and change the tape.
Okay, wow.